The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I thought she was very active.
Okay, can we get started? Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Vince Alexander. I teach evidence at St. John's Law School in New York, and I'm delighted to be here with you today. Sure, you're really thrilled to be here too. Right, Sunday, Friday afternoon. What better way to spend one time with an evidence lecture, right? Let me take my hat off to you. I think you're doing the right thing by getting this head start in the BEAT program. The final analysis, I think we're glad doing this extra work. We're going to be doing some problems here, filling in the blanks as we go along with a little bit of evidence law, as you would encounter it on a multi-state bar examination. How many here have had a course in evidence? Wonderful. This will all sound very, very familiar to you, right? And if it doesn't, that's why you're here. Right? So, I assume that most of the stuff will be familiar. Now, what's our source of evidence law for the multi-state exam? You know the answer to this one. The federal rules of evidence. The federal rules of evidence, as interpreted by the federal courts. That's your source of law for the multi-state bar exam questions. Exclusively federal law. You will not need your individual state rules of evidence for the multi-state exam. But, as you know, when it comes to the law of privileges, the federal rules themselves borrow from local state law in certain cases. Right? We'll explain that later. Basically, you're only going to have to deal with federal law except when it comes primarily to privileges. You'll see that in certain instances, the federal courts do use local state law of privileges. Now, on the exam itself, let me give you the three big areas of evidence that they cover. These are your major evidence topics on the multi-state exam. Number one, relevance. Number two, witnesses. Law governing witnesses. And, of course, hearsay. Those are the big three, relevance, witnesses, and hearsay. Probably between 75 and 80% of your multi-state bar exam questions will come from those three big areas. And today we're going to look at a little bit of the witnesses topic. We're going to be talking about impeachment of witnesses, which is a pretty big chunk of the overall witnesses section. Now, they also cover four minor topics on the multi-state bar exam. Those four minor topics are authentication, the best evidence rule, privileges, and we'll do a little bit of privileges today, and then the fourth minor topic is procedural considerations. So, you know, 20 to 25% of your multi-state bar exam questions will come from those four minor areas. Now, our methodology to help you learn or to refresh your recollection as to all the rules you need. Remember one thing, it's going to be very basic. Okay, remember, you're not studying to become a federal judge, right? At least not yet. I'm just going to cover the basics because that's all you need for bar exam purposes. I'm going to give you the rules up front. Okay, you're going to fill in the blanks so that you have the rules right up front. Not very much explanation. Just get the rule out there in front of you so that when you review it, it'll be spelled out for you in black and white. But then in the hypos, we cover hypos, little problem areas for three reasons. Number one, it helps accentuate the nuances, helps you understand the reasons for the rules. Secondly, provides illustrations. The best way to learn a rule is through illustrations. And then thirdly, we do the hypos because it allows you to test yourself immediately on what you have just heard. So that's the methodology. Okay, let's get started with the substance of it all. We know that evidence comes in two forms, right? There's real evidence. Real evidence, which deals with objects, tangible things that you look at. But the other type of evidence is testimonial evidence. testimonial evidence, evidence coming from witnesses, people who are testifying live, under oath, up there on the witness stand. One of the most important aspects of testimonial evidence is the issue of credibility. The credibility of the witness. Is she telling the truth? One of the most important things in all of evidence law and in the real world in fact-finding is whether or not the fact-finder is willing to accept the credibility of the witness. Now, what three factors bear upon a fact-finder's willingness to accept a witness's credibility? Okay, three things here. You know, three things help determine whether a witness is believable or credible. Perception. You know, how well did they see? How well did they hear? Perception. Secondly, of course, is memory. Did they really remember the event? And thirdly, honesty. Honesty. Are they being sincere? Are they telling the truth? Perception, memory, and honesty. Three factors bearing upon credibility. All right, so that's a little definitional point. Now, some other definitional points here before we get into the way these rules work. What do we mean by impeachment? Well, impeachment is the process by which you seek to demonstrate that a witness is not credible. Trying to show that the witness is not credible. That's what impeachment is all about. Now, the flip side of that is rehabilitation. That's the process of trying to repair the witness's credibility after the witness has been impeached. Item four here. What do we mean when we say intrinsic impeachment? That's impeachment by asking the witness questions on cross-examination. Asking questions on cross-examination for the purpose of getting the witness herself to admit the impeaching fact. You're asking questions trying to get the witness herself to admit the impeaching fact. That's what we call intrinsic impeachment. On the other hand, number five, extrinsic impeachment. Extrinsic impeachment is impeaching a witness by introducing independent evidence from a source other than the witness. Independent evidence from a source other than the witness himself. So, for example, you put in documents or you call some other witness to the stand. That's what we mean by extrinsic evidence. Now, there's they didn't print this out quite right, so put this into the left-hand margin. Why am I stressing the distinction between intrinsic evidence and the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic? Two reasons. Reason number one, for some methods of impeachment, you must first try intrinsic impeachment as a prerequisite to extrinsic impeachment. That's reason number one. That's why this is important. Sometimes, for some methods of impeachment, you must first try intrinsic impeachment as a prerequisite to extrinsic impeachment. Second reason, in two situations, you are not allowed to use extrinsic impeachment at all. Two situations, you are not allowed to use extrinsic impeachment at all. That second point, that second reason, we'll see in connection with impeachment methods number six and seven. Impeachment methods number six and seven. That's where you can't use extrinsic evidence sometimes. All right. Setting aside now, we've got those definitional points out of the way. If you hear those words later on, if you need to refresh your recollection, take just slip back to the definitional page here. Now, just for an overview, what are we going to be looking at? What are the impeachment methods? There are seven of them. First, we'll talk about prior inconsistent statements. Second method, bias, interest, or a motive to lie. third would be sensory deficiencies. Now, four, five, and six, all relate to different ways of showing bad character for truthfulness. Method number four is showing a reputation or opinion about the witness. Number five, criminal convictions of the witness. And number six, bad acts of the witness, even though there was no conviction. Those are all three of those are ways of showing bad character for truthfulness. And then finally, number seven, contradiction. That's your overview. Now we're going to look at each of these. First method of impeachment, wonderful way to mess up a witness's credibility, is to show that the witness has made a prior inconsistent statement. Here's your definition. A prior inconsistent statement is a prior statement, right? Something the witness said or wrote on a prior occasion. Something the witness said or wrote on a prior occasion. It's materially inconsistent with the witness's current trial testimony. Inconsistency between what they said before and what they're saying live now from the witness stand. The rule is this. A prior inconsistent statement may be used to, this is easy, impeach a witness. To impeach the witness. Now, there's a little bit of a greater sophistication to that than the word itself implies. By impeach, we mean to cast doubt on the witness's credibility. To cast doubt on the witness's credibility, not usually, to use the prior inconsistent statement as substantive evidence. It can only be used to impeach. That's your general rule. Not as substantive evidence. To use a prior inconsistent statement as substantive evidence may oftentimes run afoul of the hearsay rule. Right, a little interaction here with the hearsay rule. Fill in the blank on this one. A prior inconsistent statement may not be used as substantive evidence. By that we would mean to prove the truth. Can't use it to prove the truth contained within the prior statement unless you satisfy some hearsay exception. So basic rule here is you can only use a prior inconsistent statement to impeach the witness, not to prove the truth of the contents of the prior inconsistent statement. Okay, our first hypo. Defendant is being sued for negligence in a multi-vehicle accident in which the defendant was driving a Dodge and the plaintiff was driving a Pontiac. A witness takes the stand and testifies for the plaintiff that she, the witness, saw the Dodge run through the stop sign. First question here. On cross-examination, may the defendant's counsel seek to establish that a few days after the accident, the witness told the police that it was the Pontiac, not the Dodge, that ran the stop sign? Yes. Clear-cut example of a prior inconsistent statement. It's admissible to impeach this witness. This prior inconsistent statement, the inconsistency between the Dodge and the Pontiac, it's admissible to impeach the witness. She said two different things on two different occasions. Right? She's mixed up. She's not credible. We don't know which one to accept. She says two different things on two different occasions. It casts doubt on her credibility. Here's the follow-up. Could the defendant now, assuming we're going to let in this prior inconsistent statement, could the defendant now use that witness's prior statement to the police as substantive evidence that it was, in fact, the Pontiac rather than the Dodge that ran the stop sign? No, not here. Not on these facts. Sure, the prior inconsistent statement is admissible to impeach the witness to show that she's inconsistent. But here they're trying to offer it to prove the truth of the matter, to prove that the Pontiac actually ran the stop sign. No, that would violate the hearsay rule. So you generally, note the word generally, cannot use a prior inconsistent statement as substantive evidence. course, whenever you hear the word generally, you know there's going to be an exception, right? Okay, we'll get to that. Now, some procedural considerations. All right, prior and consistent statement, that's pretty obvious, straightforward. It's easy enough to see the substance of it. But be careful about the procedure in which the prior and consistent statement operates. All right, so here's something to keep in mind, procedure. Top of the next page, page 4. A witness who is being impeached with a prior and consistent statement must be given an opportunity to explain or deny the prior inconsistent statement. You probably want to write small here. Okay? Write small because we've got a lot of space. The witness must be given this opportunity to explain or deny the prior inconsistent statement. But intrinsic impeachment, remember, that means asking the witness about it. Asking the witness about it is not a prerequisite to introducing extrinsic evidence. Right? Intrinsic impeachment is not a prerequisite to introducing extrinsic evidence. So it's a timing issue. It's a timing issue here, right? That means that this inconsistent statement may be proven with extrinsic evidence. Bring out a document or bring out some other witness. The only requirement here is that the witness you're impeaching is later given an opportunity to come back to the witness stand for the purposes of explaining or denying. In other words, you don't have to ask the witness about her prior inconsistent statement first. You can just spring it on the other side later as you see fit. You do have to give them the opportunity to deny or explain. But the timing doesn't matter. The timing doesn't matter of that opportunity to explain. Now, there's an exception. If the witness is the opposing party, if the witness is the opposing party, there is no requirement that you give that particular witness an opportunity to explain or deny. Be on the lookout. Look at the status of the witness who testified. If it's the opposing party, there's a lot you can do that you wouldn't be able to do with respect to ordinary witnesses. Now, the next typo illustrates what we're talking about here. It's an auto accident case. The plaintiff takes the stand and testifies that she was wearing her seatbelt at the time of the accident. Defendant does not cross-examine her. Okay? No questions are going to be asked of the plaintiff. Then, later, during the defense, the defendant brings out Joe the bartender, who testifies that the plaintiff had told him, down at his bar about a week after the accident, that the plaintiff had not been wearing her seatbelt. Question 2A. Plaintiff makes a motion to strike on the ground that she, the plaintiff, was not given an immediate opportunity to explain or to deny the inconsistency. What's going on? Plaintiff basically is arguing that she should have been asked about the prior inconsistent statement during cross-examination. That's basically what she's saying here, that there should have been intrinsic impeachment. Should have been intrinsic impeachment first is what she's saying. Why? So that she could immediately try to deny it or explain it. But this witness, the plaintiff, is the opposing party of the defendant. This plaintiff is the opposing party. And there is no need to give this witness any opportunity to explain or deny. Regardless of whether you're doing it while they're originally on the stand or later, this is the opposing party. You don't have to give any opportunity to the opposing party to explain or deny the inconsistency. A couple more questions here. Is plaintiff's statement admissible to impeach the plaintiff? Of course. The plaintiff takes the stand as a witness. It most certainly may be used to impeach her credibility, because what she said to Joe about not wearing her seatbelt obviously is inconsistent with her trial testimony. It makes her look like she's all mixed up, or worse, she's lying. But one final question here. Is the plaintiff's statement admissible as substantive evidence that she was not wearing her seatbelt at the time of the accident? The answer is yes. This time the answer is yes. Now remember, the usual rule is that a prior inconsistent statement cannot be used as substantive evidence. But remember I said there's an exception if a hearsay exception is applicable. And it just so happens that what you have here is a party admission, an admission made by the opposing party. Now, you're going to spend a lot of time this summer on hearsay. We don't spend a lot of time on it today. You'll see that hearsay issues often overlap with all the other various issues of evidence, so this is kind of sneaked in at this point, so you see it in context. The plaintiff is the opponent, right? Anything a party says can be used against the party as substantive evidence. We call that the party admission. You couldn't do this with an ordinary witness, but a plaintiff or a defendant, they are not ordinary witnesses. Right? Each party can use statements against the other party as substantive evidence. All right, so there's your substance and procedure in connection with the prior inconsistent statement. What do we have next? The next two are pretty straightforward, pretty easy stuff. Method of impeachment number two is showing that the witness has a bias or an interest in the case or some kind of a motive to misrepresent. Bias is defined as a relationship between the witness and a party or some other stake in the outcome of the litigation, something that could cause the witness to have a motive to lie. Typical examples. The party herself. Obviously, if the plaintiff takes the stand, she's biased in favor of her own case. And that would affect her credibility. Same thing if the defendant testified. A witness who happens to be a friend or a relative or an employee of a party. Obviously, that would give rise to a bias. If somebody's been paid, a witness who's been paid to testify, like an expert witness, a hired gun, obviously biased. Someone with a grudge, some kind of long-standing grudge, would create a bias. And basically anyone who has a stake in the outcome of the case. Substantively, that's pretty straightforward. Procedurally, bias is so important that bias may always be proven with extrinsic evidence. Bias may always be proven with extrinsic evidence. It's a really important factor bearing upon a person's credibility. And for purposes of the bar exam, a witness should be confronted with the alleged bias before resorting to extrinsic evidence. So for bar exam purposes, the general rule here is, yes, you would use intrinsic impeachment. Ask the witness about the bias before proving it with extrinsic evidence. Next, we have sensory deficiencies. Anything that could affect a person's perception or memory, like bad eyesight, bad hearing, mental infirmities, alcohol consumption, drug consumption, regardless of whether they had had a flask just before the accident or if they had a flask out in the hallway before taking the witness stand. It happens. And that could, of course, affect their ability. Procedurally, this should say intrinsic impeachment. Intrinsic impeachment is not required as a prerequisite. Intrinsic impeachment not required as a prerequisite. Extrinsic impeachment is allowed in the first instance. Extrinsic impeachment is allowed in the first instance. In other words, do it however you want. You've got a witness up on the stand. If you want to ask them Hey, it's screwed if you had a bottle of scotch before you witnessed the action. That's fine. You can do it intrinsically. You wouldn't have to. You simply later bring out a buddy or a friend who's been with the witness and say, yeah, we both finished off a bottle of scotch before the accident. Do it as you see fit. All right, now, the next three methods, 4, 5, and 6, all deal with a generalized attack, on the witness's character for truthfulness. That's the goal with respect to methods 4, 5, and 6. They each go at this character issue a little bit different ways, three different ways to be sure, but the overall goal is to attack character for truthfulness. All right, method number four. Introducing reputation or opinion testimony about the witness's bad character for truthfulness. Now, sometimes in this context, you will often see the word veracity. Let's spell that for you there. You'll see that sometimes they use that term on the multi-state exam. And that simply means character trait of being truthful. That's what veracity means, the character trait of being truthful. So you may see it that way, phrased in that kind of terminology on the bar exam itself. Now, here's the rule for method number four. A party may impeach a witness. We'll call that the target witness. By calling out another witness, we'll call that person the character witness. And the character witness is going to testify about the target witness's bad character for veracity. How is this done? What is the form of the testimony that a character witness gives? Right? Two things. A and B here. Two things. This is what the character witness can give us. Letter A. Reputation of the target witness for truthfulness. The reputation of the target witness for truthfulness. What people say about their truthfulness in their community. All right? Their residence, place of work, school, business, community, their reputation in the relevant community. Or, letter B, the character witness can give an opinion. An opinion about the target witness's veracity. That's when the character witness actually knows the target witness personally. Yeah, I've known him since kindergarten. I've seen him in a lot of contexts. In my opinion, this person is not very honest or truthful. Letter C tells us what is not allowed. What is not allowed are specific acts that illustrate the lack of truthfulness. We don't allow specific acts that show lack of truthfulness. Procedurally, any witness who has testified may be impeached by this methodology. And yes, extrinsic evidence is allowed. Intrinsic evidence, intrinsic impeachment is not required. You don't have to ask a witness, hey, isn't it true that you have a lousy reputation for truthfulness? Nah, you don't do that. You just go ahead and bring out your character witness. Bringing out your character witness is the intrinsic evidence that is allowed. Okay, hypo three. Wally testifies for the prosecution that he saw the defendant running from the crime scene. During the defense, the defendant brings out Reverend Jerry, who knows Wally. And Reverend Jerry's going to testify that Wally has a lousy reputation for truthfulness among the members of Reverend Jerry's congregation. And furthermore, Reverend Jerry's opinion, Wally is not a truthful person. Is Reverend Jerry's testimony admissible to impeach Wally? Yes, this is exactly how it's done. Reverend Jerry's testimony about Wally's reputation, his reputation for truthfulness, and Reverend Jerry's opinion about Wally's truthfulness. He can give an opinion because he knows him personally. That's admissible. Admissible to suggest that Wally is not a very truthful person. And if he's not a truthful person in general, the implication is that he's not giving honest testimony on the witness stand. That's the whole purpose of this, to suggest that this person is not giving honest testimony on the witness stand. Now, here's the follow-up, 3B. Could Reverend Jerry follow up his opinion or his reputation testimony as follows? All right, let me tell you how I reached my opinion of Wally. During the past year, he lied to me on 6 separate occasions. No. That is what we call specific act evidence. Specific act evidence not allowed from a character witness. Not allowed from a character witness. Even though it's relevant, it's probative. Picture paints a, you know, a picture says 1,000 words, right? The reason we don't allow specific act evidence in this context, not because it's not probative, but because it can get time-consuming. Time-consuming to start giving specific instances or specific acts. So for pragmatic reasons, that's why we don't allow specific acts. Reputation or opinion? How long does that take? 20, 30 seconds at most? Okay. We'll allow reputation and opinion, but that's all that we allow from a character witness. We don't want to turn it into a mini-trial for all the various acts of dishonesty that the person may have engaged in. However, moving on to impeachment method number 5. There's one kind of specific act about a witness that we might very well allow, and that's a criminal conviction. So that's our next method, number 5, impeachment with the witness's criminal convictions. The theory here is that a person who's been convicted of a crime is thought to be more likely to lie under oath on the witness stand than as compared to somebody who has not been convicted. It's a long-standing 200-year-old inference that is just part and parcel of our evidence system. All right, first issue. First issue with respect to criminal convictions, it's a time limit rule. To be admissible, a conviction or release from prison, whichever is later, must be within 10 years of this trial. Well, the conviction must basically be within 10 years of this trial. Anything beyond 10 years, it gets too remote. It loses its probative value. That's the thinking there. Okay, so that's the first issue, the timing issue. Now, what types of convictions can be used for impeachment? Letter C. Crimes involving dishonesty or false statement, automatic admissibility. Assuming it's within 10 years. If it's a conviction for a crime involving dishonesty or false statement, automatic admissibility. Now, what do we mean by dishonesty or false statement? It's a crime that, by definition, involves lying, affirmative lying, or a betrayal of trust, like embezzlement. An employee who secretly steals money from the employer. That's an act of deceit. That would be included in this category. Perjury, false statement, fraud, embezzlement, not crimes of violence or drug crimes or theft, as you usually know, walking off with somebody's laptop. That's not considered an act of dishonesty, according to federal judicial interpretations, right? Federal courts have said we want to keep this category narrow. Why do we want to keep this category narrow? Because we have no discretion. It's automatic admissibility. As soon as we label a crime one of dishonesty or false statement, bingo, we lose our discretion to keep it out. It's automatically allowed into evidence. And so they have excluded crimes of theft in this category. Right? In other words, it's got to be a truth-telling type crime. Not mere theft. All right, now, what about any other crimes? Well, if it's another crime, in other words, some other crime not involving dishonesty or false statement, here are your rules. First of all, if it's a misdemeanor, not admissible at all. For impeachment. If it's just a mere misdemeanor, again, assuming it doesn't involve dishonesty or false statement, a mere misdemeanor, not admissible at all for impeachment. Felonies, if it's a felony, not involving dishonesty or false statement, a felony is admissible if the probative value, if the probative value of the conviction on the issue of credibility, probative value on the issue of credibility outweighs the risk of unfair prejudice to a party. Probative value on the issue of credibility outweighs the risk of unfair prejudice to a party, then the judge has discretion. Judge has discretion to allow the felony to be used for impeachment. Danger of unfair prejudice. What do we mean by that? In this context, what we mean is the danger that the jury will misuse the impeachment evidence, and apply it directly to liability or guilt. The danger of applying mere impeachment evidence more directly to the issue of liability or guilt. They mix it up, the jury does, and misuse it. They can't keep the impeachment in its proper perspective. That's the danger. All right, that's the rule. See how it works. Typo 4. Defendant's being prosecuted in a federal court for arson. Comes the trial. The defendant takes the stand to testify in his own behalf, urging that the fire at the warehouse was an accident. On cross-examination, may the prosecutor properly ask the defendant, letter A, isn't it true, Mr. Defendant, that you were convicted 8 years ago of the misdemeanor of income tax fraud? Yes. Yeah, that's okay. First of all, it's within 10 years. Within 10 years. And income tax fraud is a crime of dishonesty or false statement. This is a crime of dishonesty or false statement. It's a form of lying to the government. Lying to the government. Even though it's a misdemeanor. Even though it's a misdemeanor, it's automatically admissible. Automatically admissible. The court has no discretion to exclude it. There's no balancing of probative value. It's automatically admissible. Letter B. Isn't it true, Mr. Defendant, that you were released from prison 9 years ago for a misdemeanor conviction for the possession of marijuana? No. No good. First of all, marijuana possession is merely a misdemeanor, obviously. It's not a crime of dishonesty or false statement. Not a crime of dishonesty or false statement. It's not a felony. Sorry, no good. Can't use it. Not admissible to impeach the witness. Letter C, top of the next page. Isn't it true, Mr. Defendant, that you were convicted 2 years ago of the misdemeanor of shoplifting? No, not admissible. First of all, it's a misdemeanor, not a felony. So the issue then becomes, is shoplifting a crime of dishonesty or false statement? And the answer is no. Not the way, at least, if the answer is no, according to the federal court. Shoplifting is a crime of theft. A crime of theft. And the federal courts say that's not really a truth-telling type crime. It's not really a deceitful way of behavior. Sure, it's not a proper way to acquire property, but we don't think that the drafters of the federal rules had theft in mind when they created the category of dishonesty or false statement. So that is the answer you must give on the multi-state exam. Remember, the multi-state exam goes for majority rules. And you'll find a few federal district judges who will push the envelope on that and say, I really don't agree with what the circuit says on this. But that's not the answer you need to focus on. You need to focus on the majority rule. The majority of federal courts say that theft is not a crime of dishonesty. The only way you could get a theft crime in for impeachment is if it were a felony. The theft crime is merely a misdemeanor. You're out of luck. No good for impeachment. 4D. Mr. Defendant, isn't it true that you were convicted 5 years ago for felony assault? Here's the definitive answer on this one. Maybe. The answer is maybe. Okay, first of all, assault is not a crime of dishonesty or false statement. Assault is not dishonesty or false statement, so you don't get automatic admissibility. But it is a felony. It is a felony. And if it is a felony, the court has discretion to allow the felony for impeachment if the court determines in its discretion that the probative value on credibility outweighs the danger of prejudice. So that's why the answer is maybe. You cannot give a definitive answer that it is or it isn't. It's up to the judge after weighing probative value against the danger of unfair prejudice. Now, here are some suggestions for you in terms of balancing probative value and the danger of unfair prejudice. Not that you would have to make any kind of individualized balancing on the multi-state exam itself. Remember, on the multi-state exam, it's just multiple choice questions. It would be pretty tough to require balancing on an ad hoc basis with a multiple choice question. But, you know, you're also probably going to have to deal with essays. In most of the states, the local essay exams are involved in evidence. So you might have to apply some balancing in the context of an essay. So you can use these basic guidelines. The first question here, what are the factors that make a conviction probative? Well, the seriousness of the crime. Obviously, the more serious the crime is, the more likely it is that this witness really holds society in contempt. And if you hold society in contempt, you're not likely to take an oath very seriously while you're up on a witness stand. So a prior serious conviction is going to be fairly probative. Murder. A murder conviction obviously is more probative on the issue of credibility than possessing marijuana. Another factor would be, what is the relationship between the prior crime and the concept of trust and deception? Theft, even though it's not automatically admissible, is certainly closer to credibility issues than would be reckless driving or driving while under the influence of alcohol. Well, we have a felony assault. Felony assault is pretty serious. On the other hand, it's not terribly closely related to trust and deception. So felony assault is kind of in the middle. What are the factors that make a conviction unfairly prejudicial? Well, if it's an inflammatory crime, like child molestation, obviously that's more prejudicial than a DWI. Another unfair prejudice factor would be a situation where the prior crime is very similar to the one with which a defendant, especially a criminal defendant, is currently charged. And if the criminal defendant himself took the stand, and he's got a prior conviction for a crime that's very similar, there's a very serious danger there that the jury will misuse the prior conviction. They won't be able to limit it to the impeachment value. They may generalize and think, well, gee, this defendant's a really bad person in general, so let's hold him guilty because of his bad past. So that would be an unfair prejudice factor. Procedural issues. How and when may you prove prior convictions? First of all, you could do it intrinsically. Intrinsically. In other words, it's okay to ask the witness about it while the witness is up on the stand during cross-examination. That's the way we were doing it in the hypo. But you don't have to do it that way. All right? Extrinsically is also okay. It's either or. Ask them about it if you want to, or skip the questions and simply prove the conviction extrinsically by bringing out a record of conviction. So in other words, intrinsic impeachment is not a prerequisite to extrinsic proof of the conviction. Intrinsic impeachment, not a prerequisite to the use of extrinsic evidence. And in terms of timing, no problem there. You don't have to give the witness an opportunity to deny or explain it. Complete freedom on the part of the party doing the impeachment. Top of the next page. I want you to insert this word where you see bad acts without a conviction. Insert this. Questions about bad acts. That's a better way to remember it. Questions about bad acts where there's been no conviction. Bad acts that reflect negatively on the witness's character for truthfulness. Here's the rule for this one, method six. A witness may be asked about prior bad acts if those acts relate to truthfulness. A witness may be asked about bad acts if those acts relate to truthfulness. They don't have to be bad acts that are criminal in nature. Okay? Fibbing on your resume is a bad act involving lack of truthfulness. But it's not criminal. Ordinarily, it's not criminal to put out a false resume. But it certainly puts your truthfulness, your character for truthfulness, in a bad light. Now, some limitations on this method. This method is subject to several limitations. First of all, the cross-examiner must have a good faith basis to believe that the bad act occurred. A good faith basis. In other words, you can't make this stuff up and just rattle off a whole bunch of potential bad acts. Say, hey, would you ever do this? Did you ever do that? No. You got to have some foundation for asking the question. A good faith basis. Now, how do you do it? What's your proof? The bad act may be proven by intrinsic evidence only. Intrinsic evidence only. You ask the questioner, and if the witness admits it, you got it. Intrinsic. In other words, you ask the question and they admit it, you've impeached them intrinsically. But if the witness denies it, the cross-examiner is stuck with the witness's answer. In other words, extrinsic evidence is not allowed to prove a prior bad act. Extrinsic evidence is not allowed to prove a prior bad act in a situation where there's no conviction. In a situation where there was no conviction. You're stuck with their answer. There's nothing you can do about it. We put in a little exam tip here. Because remember, what we're talking about is using a prior bad act to suggest bad character for truthfulness. But having had an evidence course, you know that there are all types of different purposes for which a party might be introducing evidence. And just because you can't get it in for one purpose, sometimes you can get the same item of evidence in for a different purpose. So a little exam tip on that point. Be on the lookout for alternative purposes for the use of bad acts. All right, let's try it out. Hypo 5. Witness testifies for the defense that the defendant drove through the intersection at a very slow speed. Hypo 5A. We're cross-examining this witness. Plaintiff asks the witness whether she assaulted her mail carrier 2 years ago. No charges were ever brought, so obviously there's no conviction. Defendant objects. How should the court rule? Objection sustained. Objection sustained. Defendant's right. This question, asking the witness if she ever assaulted her mail carrier, does not involve a bad act relating to truthfulness. Assault does not involve a bad act relating to truthfulness. This method of impeachment is very focused. It's got to be a bad act involving lack of truthfulness. So that question is off limits. Objection sustained. All right, let's try again. 5B. On cross-examination, plaintiff asks the witness whether she made false statements in an application for food stamps 4 years ago. Again, no charges were ever brought, so obviously there's been no conviction. Defendant objects. How should the court rule? Objection overruled. Objection overruled. There's been no conviction here, right? But this is a bad act involving lack of truthfulness. False application for food stamps, that's a bad act involving lack of truthfulness. And if the witness admits, filing the false application, then you've got impeachment. It tends to cast doubt on the witness's current credibility. The thought being, gee, if this person has lied on a prior occasion, that makes it somewhat more likely that this person would be willing to lie today on the witness stand. Okay, that's the relevance of it. If she admits that she lied on a prior occasion, it casts doubt on her current credibility. But, 5C, same cross-examination. But now let's assume that the witness vehemently denies making those false statements in the application for food stamps. Plaintiff says, okay, fair enough. Plaintiff now wants to call out a welfare agent to prove that the witness made those prior false statements. No, cannot do it. Cannot do it. Remember, this is not a conviction. Not a conviction. Plaintiff may ask. Plaintiff may ask about prior untruthful acts, but that's as far as it goes. If the witness denies, the prior bad act, then the cross-examiner is stuck with the witness's answer. In other words, no extrinsic evidence. No extrinsic evidence to show the witness's bad character for truthfulness. Not in this context. If you're using the prior bad act to show the witness's bad character for truthfulness, you cannot use extrinsic evidence. You may say to yourself, no, 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 yes, that doesn't make a lot of sense. They really did it. Just to be able to prove it, to show that they're not very credible. Yeah, it would be probative, but it becomes time-consuming, distracting. It becomes a little mini-trial, and it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. Convictions, that's different. Conviction is quick and easy to prove. 20 seconds, you prove it. Also, a conviction is a very public act of condemnation, and that explains why the difference in approach. There's convictions which are provable with extrinsic evidence, and mere prior bad acts, which you can't do with extrinsic evidence. Typo 6. United States government against Rush for narcotics sales. Witness Winona testifies for Rush. And on cross-examination, Winona is asked whether she was arrested. Is it true, Winona, you were arrested 3 years ago for passing counterfeit money? Objectionable? Yes, objection sustained. Well, now, wait a minute. Isn't this a prior bad act involving deceit and a lack of truthfulness? Passing counterfeit money? That's a deceitful way to pass off money. Isn't that a prior bad act involving lack of truthfulness? Yes, it is. But here's the problem. To suggest bad character for truthfulness, you are not allowed to ask the witness if the witness was arrested for the bad act. Look at the way the question was asked. Isn't it true you were arrested for passing counterfeit money? You're not allowed to ask the witness if the witness was arrested for the bad act. Why is that? An arrest is merely an accusation. An indictment is merely an accusation. It doesn't mean they did it. And the danger here is jury confusion. Jury confusion. The folks in the jury box didn't go to law school. They don't know all the distinctions between arrests, indictments, convictions, instruments, accusatory instruments, and so forth. They hear those terms, and in their minds, they mix it all up. And we don't want that. Because we all know that an arrest doesn't mean you did it. So, you're not allowed to ask the witness if he was arrested for the passing of the counterfeit money. But if you really did pass, if the witness here really did pass the counterfeit money, is it that relevant? Is it that probative? Yes, it is. So here's what you can do. Simply ask the witness point blank. 3 years ago, did you pass counterfeit money? You can ask the witness about the underlying acts. Isn't it true you passed counterfeit money? That's allowed. Just don't ask them if they were arrested for it. Keep the word arrest out of it. You can ask about the underlying act. You just cannot ask about the arrest when you're using it to prove bad character for truthfulness. Because an arrest does not affect your character. The act might affect your character, but not the arrest itself. All right, so be careful of that little scenario. But hypo 7 is where it gets tricky. All right? This is tricky. Hypo 7, prosecution of Donald for bank robbery. Winston testifies for the prosecution. On cross-examination, Winston is asked, "Isn't it true, Winston, that you were arrested a month ago for selling marijuana and you are now awaiting trial on those charges?" Is that proper? Yes. Yes, it is. How can that be? Your first reaction might very well be, wait a minute. Selling marijuana is not really a bad act involving truthfulness, all right? You can be a very honest seller of marijuana. And it's just an arrest. I thought you weren't allowed to ask the witness if he was arrested for something. Well, yes, if you're trying to show bad character for truthfulness. But here, Winston's arrest is relevant to something separate from bad character for truthfulness. Winston's arrest is relevant to something separate from bad character for truthfulness. Winston's arrest is a source of bias. Winston's arrest is a source of bias. Look at the context. Winston is a witness for the prosecution. A witness for the prosecution. A witness for the prosecution. If he's under arrest, some crime of his own, has a motive to curry favor with the authorities. If Winston has criminal difficulties of his own, he has a motive to curry favor with the government. Testify the way the government wants him to testify so that he can get a good deal for himself. Connection with his own criminal difficulties here. Right, his marijuana problem. Sales of marijuana. That gives him a bias. Gives him a bias. Which is a completely different ground for impeachment. A completely different ground for impeachment. Remember I said, be careful. Sometimes evidence which is not admissible for one purpose, like bad character, here you see it might be admissible for a different purpose on these circumstances, and that different purpose here, of course, is bias. And if Winston is dumb enough to deny that he's been under arrest for marijuana sales and so forth, in these circumstances, you can prove it with extrinsic evidence. Because this is a bias. bias can always be proven with extrinsic evidence. Remember, bias is a very important form of impeachment. And the rules on bias might, in effect, trump other limiting rules that you encounter. The rules on bias oftentimes trump other exclusionary rules. Because it's a very important form of impeachment related to witness credibility. Okay, final method of impeachment. Contradiction. Here's the rule. We're going to let you impeach a witness by showing that the witness made a mistake or lied about some fact, something she testified to during direct examination. We're going to let you try to show that the testimony she gave is contradicted by some fact that she said something about a particular fact, and you're going to show that in truth the fact is just the opposite. It's a contradictory fact. That's the idea of impeachment by contradiction. Now, here's your procedural issues. If the contradiction involves an issue in the case that is significant, then we're going to let you prove the contradictory fact by extrinsic evidence. Yeah, we'll let you use extrinsic evidence if it's a significant issue. But, point two, if the contradiction goes to a matter that is collateral, by collateral we mean insignificant to the issues in the case, then, if it's collateral, proof is limited to intrinsic impeachment or intrinsic evidence. And if it's intrinsic, remember, if you can only use intrinsic, it means you can ask about it, but you can't prove it if the witness sticks to her story. If the witness sticks to her story, then you're stuck also. You're stuck with her story if it's a collateral point. So, hypo 8. Auto accident case. Witness testifies to the plaintiff that while leaning up against a maple tree at the corner of Main Street and Sewell Street, he saw that the traffic light was red for the defendant as the defendant's car entered the intersection and hit the plaintiff. Cross-examination, witnesses asked, is it true that the tree at the intersection of Main and Sewell Street is an oak tree? A maple tree. The witness says, I got it right. During the defense, may the defendant properly bring out a municipal employee to testify that the tree at the corner of Main and Sewell is, in fact, an oak tree? And, of course, the answer is no. This would be a collateral contradiction. A collateral contradiction. It's trivial. Maple tree, oak tree, it's not a big deal. Therefore, no extrinsic evidence. No extrinsic evidence. Sure, you could ask the witness about it on cross-examination. You can ask about the contradiction on cross-examination. And if the witness admits it, oh, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
It is an oak tree.
Wow, you've impeached him. Whatever, trivial point. But that's only intrinsic, and we'll let you do that. But if they stick to their story, sorry, it's not worth it. No extrinsic evidence allowed on this point. Notice, I'm not talking about a prior inconsistent statement. No, I'm talking about a prior, it's not even a prior thing. It's simply a contradictory fact. A contradictory fact. So don't confuse this with prior inconsistent statements. This is not something the witness said on a prior occasion. It's just a mistake as to the existence of the fact. But now, hypo 8b, on cross-examination, we ask the witness, isn't it true that the traffic light at the intersection of Main and Sewell was not functioning at all on the day in question? And the witness says, oh, no. I was thinking of my story. My testimony was accurate. Now, during the defense, could the defendant properly bring out a police officer to testify that the light at the intersection of Main and Sewell was not functioning at all on the day in question? Yes. This contradictory fact is not collateral. This contradictory fact is not collateral. Extrinsic evidence is okay here. Yes, extrinsic evidence is okay. But this is an important issue in the case. This is an important issue in the case. Was the light red? Not a liability might turn on whether the light was red. Well, how could the light be red if the light wasn't functioning at all on the day in question? That contradictory fact is a material issue. It's a significant, important issue in the case. And that contradictory fact can be proven with extrinsic evidence. Go ahead. Bring out a separate witness to prove extrinsically that particular contradictory fact. One final point, then we'll take our break. Can you impeach your own witness? Usually when we talk about impeachment, we're assuming that you're impeaching the other side's witness. And sure, of course you can do that. But what if your own witness takes the stand and turns out to be Benedict Arnold, stabs you in the back with testimony that hurts your case? Can you then turn around and impeach your own witness? Yes. Yes, here's the rule. A witness may be impeached by any party. Any party, including the party who called the witness. So, free and open impeachment of anybody you want to impeach, including your very own witness. Okay, take 10 minutes, and then we'll go straight through till the end.